Hi everybody, today is Friday, October 25th, and we're having Larry Johnson with us. Welcome back, Larry.
I'm back, like a bad disease.
Larry, let's start with what's going on between Iran and Israel.
Yeah.
Today we've learned that New York Times reported that Iran is getting prepared for a big conflict if Israel attacks Iran. With Israel.
Sure.
And earlier we've learned that the Times reported that Israel is postponing their attack on Iran because of the leaked documents. How do you find it right now between Iran and Israel? Is Israel preparing for a big conflict with Iran, a big war in the Middle East that could bring the United States in?
Well, everybody's sure talking tough. Israel's been making threats now for 3 weeks. But let's recall that the Iranian ballistic missile strike that hit Israel was October 1st. And in the immediate aftermath, it sounded like Israel was going to fire back that night. And then the next day, we're going to get them. We're coming. So Israel keeps announcing that it is going to attack, which, you know, for the life of me, I don't understand it. You know, if I'm going to attack you, I'm not going to announce it. I'm going to sucker punch you. I'm going to hit you when you're not prepared, because I would rather fight an undefended person because I'm a bully, you know? And yet here's Israel talking up about all the, you know, all the things that they're going to do to Iran. They've been delayed in part, I think. One, this leak of intelligence that occurred last week, certainly, I think, gave them pause, because it exposed, it didn't lay out Israel's plans in terms of what they were going to hit, but it certainly gave an insight into one of the attack vectors, you know, using air-launched ballistic missiles that would be launched from aircraft. It's still not clear that that was a, you know, it was not, that intelligence that was leaked was not a full account of Israel's capabilities and what they might do. But, you know, once Iran launched that attack on October 1st, the Iranians realized that they were going to face retaliation from Israel. I mean, they're not stupid. We sometimes act like these Iranians are, mentally deficient and have no sense of any, you know, that if we do X, someone's going to do Y. So Iran has been cooperating closely now with Russia in preparing defenses. Both in increasing air defense systems, bringing in Russian advisors, troops that are capable of manning those systems, or at least training the Iranians to use them properly. So now we're in a wait and see mode. I think there's been a lot of diplomatic pressure behind the scenes from both the United States, Russia, and China on Israel, to keep Israel from actually retaliating. Because if Israel goes forward with this attack on Iran, Iran is going to respond and respond immediately. And it will then cause significant damage both to infrastructure and military personnel and possibly civilians in Israel. Israel's going to get hit in a way that it has never been hit before in its entire 76-year existence. That the notion that they can't be attacked and suffer, you know, suffer enormous damage, like what they're inflicting upon Beirut, Lebanon, as an example, it's going to come home. And this really, they could get hurt in such a way that Netanyahu, if he survives, would be likely to use nuclear weapons, to launch a nuclear device at Iran. And then We're up an escalatory ladder at that point that is literally going to change the world. That's what people are trying to avoid. But I don't think we will. The problem with the Israelis is, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the expression, they read their own press clippings. So, you know, they write the story about, hey, I am such a great guy and I do all this wonderful stuff. And they read it and say, man, I am the best, when they're really not. But they've convinced themselves, and they've structured their own little fantasy world, live in that fantasy world. You know, because I've been in some exchanges. I wouldn't call it conversations, because when you talk to some of these Zionists, they're not interested in a conversation, in a back and forth. They're going to tell you what reality is. And this one individual that I'm thinking of, he's an American, but he goes, yeah, Israel's going to hit Iran and take out its leadership and destroy its oil and destroy its nuclear divide, nuclear sites, and it will crumble and the society will fall apart. And I go, they've been fighting Hamas now for 13 months, 14 months, and have failed to defeat Hamas. And Hamas is, you know, doesn't even begin to have the size of military force that Iran does, and it doesn't have the missiles, doesn't have the technology, doesn't have the air defense system, doesn't have the aircraft, doesn't, you know. And you guys, your Zionist thugs in Israel can't beat Hamas, but you're going to take on Iran? Do you guys even pay attention to what you're doing? And try to tell them the same thing with going into southern Lebanon against Hezbollah. Israel's suffering, you know, really significant casualties now. They didn't suffer a lot of casualties in Gaza, because again, you're basically fighting against unarmed people. You know, anybody can be a tough guy if you're fighting a kid in a wheelchair. Man, I kicked his ass. Yeah, he couldn't get out of the wheelchair, and he was, you know, weak and incapacitated. Iran's not that. So that's the danger here. This thing can just spin out of control.
Do you think the latest visit of Antony Blinken to Israel was part of this campaign of putting pressure on Israel?
But, you know, Blinken is at best a useful idiot. You know, I call him an enabler of the Zionist genocide. That's all he does. Yeah, because, you know, look, if Biden, Blinken, this crowd, if they were serious, they could bring this killing to a halt tomorrow. And it would simply say to Israel, no, we're stopping all military flow. We're pulling our military assets out, and you're not getting another dime until you sit down and you come to a peace agreement and negotiate a ceasefire with Hamas, with Hezbollah. This stops now. They don't do that because the politics of it, there's too much money from Jewish sources. I mean, it's, you know, we're not trying to demonized Judaism, but, you know, it's primarily wealthy, wealthy Jews in the United States that are funding this money, along with money that's coming out of Israel into political coffers, that's the real irony, because Israel can barely maintain, you know, it's suffering economic collapse, but yet it's still pumping money into the U.S. electoral system. It interferes when it comes to meddling in our elections. Israel does it more than any other country in the world and gets away with it. So the politics of it just don't work. So the United States is not going to do that. It should, but it won't.
It seems that the policy of the Biden administration is totally the opposite of what you've said. Just instead of cutting aid, cutting weapons to Israel, they're just bribing Netanyahu, hoping that he's going to change his attitude. Right now, we've learned before coming out, I've learned that they're going to send a new air defense system, a new TAT, to Israel. And it seems bribing, not cutting them from weapons.
It's not bribing, but I mean, it is. They're simply enabling. You know, on the one hand, they said, "Hey, you better start allowing humanitarian aid in, and we're going to give you 30 days. And if you don't, boy, there'll be consequences." Yeah, like what? Oh, and by the way, we're sending you not one, not two, but three THAADs. I guess it's up to three now. So that reflects the fact that the United States probably has intelligence about what Iranian activities are, and recognize that Iran has got the capacity to launch a really major strike against Israel. But unlike the attacks, you know, Iran's first launch was in April, then followed by the October 1st. This next round will be in response to an Israeli attack, and it's not going to be telegraphed in advance. The previous two, Iran consulted both with Washington, with Moscow, with other governments, gave them a heads up, because the Iranian attack was designed to send a message, demonstrate a capability, not inflict damage. This next go round will be one to hurt Israel and hurt them bad.
And when it comes to Antony Blinken's visit, when he was leaving Israel, he said that Israel is strategically winning the conflict. And what does he mean by that? Is he trying to convince them that you're winning? Let's go after negotiations. Let's find some sort of solution. Let's stop escalating the conflict with Iran, because we have to understand what's in his mind and what is he trying to do with Israel.
Who do you mean? Blinken?
Antony Blinken. Antony Blinken.
Well, he's grasping at straws. You know, look, to solve this issue, you've got to come down and grapple with the fundamental problem. What's the cause of it? Israel, the Zionist mentality believes that from the river to the sea, all of that land belongs to Jews. It does not belong to anyone else. Anybody else, the Amaleks, which Netanyahu has talked about, and the Zionists talk about it when they're speaking Hebrew. You know, a lot of times they hide what they're saying when they're doing it in English. But it's to exterminate, remove the Palestinians, the Lebanese, the Syrians, the Iraqis, the Saudis, get out. It's our land. So when you're dealing with that mentality, there's no space for negotiation in that. I mean, that's the reality of what we're dealing with. So at that point, you know, think of it as they're like, if you've got a kid who's a drug addict, addicted to meth, and you continue to allow them to live in your home, you continue to give them money, you continue to feed them, they're going to keep doing meth. At some point, you got to cut them off and force them to deal with the consequences of what they are doing, and it may end up with their death. That's a situation we are with Israel right now, because they refuse to return to the pre-1967 borders. They refuse to allow the Palestinians to have an independent state. And the Palestinians, by their token too, they're not going to give up. The only way you're going to get them to relinquish their desire to have an independent homeland and state is to exterminate them all. So, I mean, what we're talking about is so horrific. And, you know, here's Blinken trying to get Netanyahu to say, hey, you killed Sinwar, you killed the head of Hamas, so take a win, declare victory, and call off the fight. On the belief that this was just about trying to track down Sinwar and kill Sinwar. If only we kill Sinwar, boy, all of our problems are solved. That's not what this is about. So, you know, we need to sort of stop pretending that there is, you know, candidly, a negotiated settlement. There is no negotiation possible with the Zionists. They're not going, and I'm talking to people like Smotrich, the finance minister, Ben-Gvir, their homeland security chief. It is, you know, they don't have a compromise in their vocabulary. Can't spell it, can't pronounce it.
And when they're talking about Sin War, Larry, it seems that they're thinking that Sin War was created in another planet and came to Gaza. He was created in Gaza. He was the outcome of what has happened to Gaza, to Palestinians. Yeah. There are a lot of Sin War right now, a lot of people who we can call them Sin War in Gaza Strip right now, in the West Bank. Do they really consider any of these concerns that they have to understand it? In your opinion, is there any sort of sense on their part to understand it?
You mean on the part of the Israelis?
Israelis.
Oh, no. Heavens no. There's no empathy, or at least among the leadership. Now, some stories have started to emerge. And I've made this point before on your show that Israeli military is conducting itself in a manner much similar to how the Nazis behaved as they went into Poland and Ukraine in the killing of civilians. Because what happened in the early part of the war in 1941, and by the end of 41, going into 42, the German commanders were appalled at the mental breakdown a lot of their soldiers were having, because these soldiers were out there shooting women, children, unarmed men. They'd be, you know, shoved into a pit and shot. And that murder of civilians, of unarmed people, was taking a toll, because anybody that has a conscience at some point is going to affect them psychologically, emotionally. Now, if they're just a psychopath with a total narcissist with no ability to feel empathy for anyone else, yeah, you're probably not going to be bothered. But fortunately, that's not a common trait among human beings. So what we see now in Israel, there's a report the other day that this one reservist, I guess he'd been a pilot, father of four, or he was, I guess, there have been two. I mean, there have been multiple suicides. So this one guy had commented that he was driving bulldozers over terrorists, living people. He's given orders to crush them beneath the bulldozer. And the anguish from that was so great, he took his life. I mean, he had four kids. I mean, imagine you're willing to kill yourself and abandon your children, that depth of despair. Well, that's starting to surface among some of the Israeli military personnel. Not all, but enough that is showing you what the real consequences of this genocidal war against these civilians is. That's why Israel is, you know, the military chiefs have decided that they can open fire and bomb hospitals and schools and charitable foundations and religious gathering spots, both not just mosques, but churches, Christian churches. It really is. It's an outrageous display, and they all do it in the name of, quote, fighting terrorism, when in fact, and was it on your show where you showed me the clip of Bibi Netanyahu, or maybe it was Danny Davis, but Danny. You got to send me that clip, because here's Bibi Netanyahu, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, defining terrorism, and he's absolutely right. It is killing civilians for a political purpose. Well, that's what Israel is now doing, and all the trips of Anthony Blinken aren't going to change that.
you're talking about
is target the innocent deliberately, and therefore my definition of terrorism is the systematic and deliberate attack, the murder, maiming, and menacing of innocents, of civilians, for political goals. You can tell a lot about terrorists, but what happens when they come to power? Those who fight for freedom and come to power do not impose terrorism. Those who do, who fight in terroristic means, end up as being masters of terrorist states.
Yeah. You got to send me that. I want to use that over and over and over. Because he's right. That's the best definition of terrorism I've ever seen. And he's now describing what Israel is. You know, people think that I'm just calling out names for, you know, just to be provocative, that Israel is a terrorist state. No, I mean, literally by definition, what they're doing, how they're doing it, it is terrorism. It's just, it's organized. It's state level.
Yeah. If you remember, Netanyahu, before going on, right after going to the southern part of Lebanon, he sent a video message to Lebanese that your enemy is Hezbollah. It seems the same kind of strategy is going on right now on the part of the United States and Israelis. They're trying, on one hand, they're trying to attack Hezbollah or the southern part of Lebanon. They're destroying the southern part of Beirut and attacking hospitals. And on the other hand, they're putting pressure on the government in Lebanon and by sending these U.S. envoy Hochstein to Lebanon to talk right. with them, to intimidate them, not talking with them.
Threaten them.
In your opinion, is that going to work in terms of what they're aiming at? Because it seems that the main goal is to separate Lebanese people from each other in order to, if this separation happens within the Lebanese community, I think that would be the end of Lebanon. They can send their people to the southern part of Lebanon, and southern part of Lebanon would become a new part of Israel.
Are you older than 42 years of age?
No.
Okay. So this has been going on since 1982. Okay, that's 42 years that the United States has been trying to, you know, get the Lebanese to stand up and fight against the Hezbollah, the Shia. Because Hezbollah really only emerged in 82. It started forming, and it was formed around the Shia Muslim population that lived there in southern Lebanon and in the Baqa Valley. And, you know, from the outset, the United States got it, you know, came in heavy on the side of Israel, and we had battleships back then that were off the coast. You know, they were the legacy of World War II, and they'd fire these enormous shells into the Baqa Valley. Well, the Shia and some of the other Amal, it was one of the other groups, they started fighting back against us. They blew up our embassy. And killed a bunch of Americans and staff members. They then attacked, we called it the Marine Barracks, but it was a building that the Marines had taken up a place to, you know, sleep, eat, organize. And after that, the United States said, okay, we're pulling out. So we've been trying to get the Lebanese people, you know, whatever that is, to push out the Shia. Well, you know, the problem with Lebanon, you know, Lebanon's been a cultural, ethnic mix. It wasn't all Shia. There was a heavy, you know, large Christian presence. The Druze are something in between Muslim and Christian. You know, the Druze are their own thing. So, part of it is just the United States has never understood Lebanon, what Lebanon is. And our policies have helped contribute to, the civil war that was fought there in the 1980s was just awful. You know, you were just a young child when that was going on. So we got 42 years of failed policy in Lebanon, and no matter how much, you know, we think, oh, if we can just defeat Hezbollah. We're not going to defeat Hezbollah, okay? Just, you're like, wake the hell up and recognize you're not going to defeat them. They're going to survive us. They're not going away. Israel does not have the ability to defeat Hezbollah at all. And we're starting to see that now with, you know, just I think the other day, Israel killed five soldiers in one attack and wounded, you know, 8-10 others. Two Hezbollah fighters did that, you know, inflicted that many casualties. Israel has barely advanced into southern Lebanon. And, you know, Hezbollah would like him to come all the way in. Because they get him in there, they'll chew him up. And then, you know, Israel doesn't have deep resources to fall back on. That's the problem.
We had the BRICS summit in Kazan, Larry. Turkey was there, Erdogan. And while they were in Kazan, we had a terrorist attack in Turkey. Mm-hmm. In your opinion, how we can understand this terrorist? Is that related to what Turkey is doing in terms of being part of, they want to be part of BRICS? Is that related to that goal in their mind?
I've seen some speculation, and there may be something to it, that Western intelligence working with the Kurds, because this was a Kurdish, the people that carried out these attacks were Kurds, did so with the encouragement of Western intelligence to send Erdogan and the rest of the Turkish military and intelligence establishment that, you know, if you're going to get in bed with the Russians, then we're gonna stir up the Kurds and, you know, have them attack you. This is, again, this shows you how short-sighted the Western policy is. Because if the Turks just, you know, they've already now stepped up their attack on the Kurds. In the past, that they may have been reluctant to do much damage to the Kurds because of pressure from the United States. Now they can say, you know, screw you, we're gonna pursue our own national security objectives. And they'll attack the Kurds. I mean, the Kurds, you know, the Kurds are people without, they're not Iraqi, they're not Turkish, they're not Iran, you know, they want to have their own place, and they're not warmly embraced in any of the three countries.
And when we're talking about Kurds, just a clarification that we're not talking about all of the Kurds, because we know there are a lot of Kurds in Iran, in Turkey, in Syria.
Yeah.
But United States has managed to have some sort of connection with some fraction of this society that we call it, yeah, Kurdish society. And they can manipulate whenever it comes to Iran, Turkey, and Syria. But at the end of the day, Larry, it can bring these three countries together, Iran, Turkey, and Syria, because they have a common enemy and they know who's behind this.
Well, Iran, Turkey, Syria, and Iraq, you know, four. I think the importance of what you saw with BRICS and Turkey's, you know, expressing interest, I think I'm not sure how serious Erdogan is in wanting to pursue that as an option. But BRICS represents sort of a new model for how nations should interact. Whereas, you know, like at the United Nations, when the leader speaks, it's one leader standing up in front of the General Assembly at the podium. But here at BRICS, it was more reminiscent of the UN Security Council, where everybody sat around a table as equals, with no one country being superior, no one country being able to veto. It'd be one thing if Iran and China said, okay, let's hear your ideas, but if we don't like it, it's not going to go anywhere. No, everybody had a voice. Creating a world in which the historical colonial powers that have been the traditional hegemons no longer get to call the shots is what I think the Global South is embracing. And frankly, yes, if you look at it simply in terms of resources, physical resources, oil, gas, nitrogen, aluminum, gold, lithium, what food? The United States still is a country that does have enormous resources. Not limitless, but a significant number. Europe, on the other hand, has nothing. They got nothing. Europe survived by exploiting the rest of the world as a colonial, as rapists, basically. They went out and subjugated other people throughout Africa, Latin America, Asia. But that is over. Yet the United States has been sort of in the lead, enabling the Europeans to continue to exercise that dominance. There's no way in the world that France and the United Kingdom should have a veto power at all at the United Nations and the Security Council. Those are like two little yappy dogs. They're insignificant countries anymore in terms of resources, in terms of military power, in terms of economic power. They're nothing. So what you're seeing now, and that's part of what I think Erdogan's sensing, is when you look at Russia, when you look at China, when you look at India, when you look at Brazil, those are all resource-rich countries. Iran, rich in resources. And not just the resources you pull out of the ground, in terms of human resources as well. The world's changing, and the problem is people here in the West are refusing to recognize it, accept it, see what's taking place.
What's so tragic about the European Union, Larry, and Europe is that they don't see it, as you've mentioned, as you've been described. They don't see it this way. They think that they still have time to just change everything. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem that it comes, because the way that they're behaving right now in Ukraine, even in the Middle East, they're just helping Israel, helping Ukraine, which doesn't make sense for the future of Europe. It doesn't seem that they can understand what's going to happen in the future. They're talking about Donald Trump, but in the future, nobody knows what's going to happen in the future for Europe. They have to have some sort of sources, some sort of friendship, partnership, and like Russia, which is so important for Europe, but it doesn't seem that would be the case for the European leaders.
Well, why does Europe want Ukraine? Resources. Of all countries in the world, in the entire world, if I recall correctly, Ukraine was listed as the fifth largest country in terms of natural resources. Coal, oil, gas, not to mention wheat. It's one of the largest, has been one of the largest food producers. That's why Europe wants Ukraine to control its resources for the benefit of the Europeans, not for the benefit of the Ukrainians. It is, it's shocking that Ukraine could be that rich in resources and be considered one of the poorest countries in Europe. How does that, it shouldn't be that way, but it was. In contrast with Russia, who is probably, I guess, listed number one in the world in terms of natural resources, by virtue of the physical size of Russia, but the various mineral resources, oil and gas, as well as grain capability to produce, it's number one. And The reason it was doing very well economically is because Putin took control and wrested control away from the oligarchs who had sold out or had been in the process of trying to sell out much of Russia's wealth to foreign owners. And Putin said, no, this is going to stop. You know, that's one of the reasons the West is so angry at Putin, because he stopped them from raping Russia.
It seems that Iran and Saudi Arabia are talking about joint naval drills in the Red Sea, mm-hmm. which is huge when it comes to the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia, for those one who know what has happened in the past between these two countries. And right now, it seems that even with this new partnership, we cannot say partnership, they are part of BRICS. And it seems that being part of BRICS can bring these two countries together even closer.
Well, BRICS has already played a major role in making that happen. 3 years ago, Iran and Saudi Arabia were locked in a proxy war in Yemen. And it didn't appear to be any resolution to it. And then as the war in Ukraine unfolded and China and Russia's relationship became closer, they then worked together to bring it, reconcile and get the diplomatic relations reestablished between Tehran and Riyadh. And as a result, it comes out, as you pointed out, they're talking about conducting joint military exercises together. Just this is last week, you saw Iran conducting joint military exercises with Oman, as well as I think the Russians were there. So, but you also saw at the sidelines of the BRICS summit, India and China were talking. Now, they've had a long-standing border dispute and that has been violent at times. They were talking. They're finding a peaceful resolution. The same with Azerbaijan and Armenia, with the conflict over the Nagorno-Karabakh. Those two leaders sat side by side and had a civil conversation, a pleasant conversation. So I think what BRICS is trying to show the world is we don't have to solve everything by seeing how many civilians we can kill. It's the opposite of what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. It's showing that there is a diplomatic way. Because one of the things the Russians do that contrasts with how the United States and most of Europe does, the United States and Europe like to go out and judge other countries. We've got a standard. We have free speech, and we have a Bill of Rights. We have all these. So we allow this political freedom in our country. And then we go out and measure and judge other countries by a standard we don't even live by. Okay? I've always conceived of, if you could draw a picture of the United States, an obese elderly woman smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day, got some chin hairs, and is doing at least a bottle of vodka a day too. So drunk, fat, laced with nicotine, trying to tell everybody else that they need to live a healthy lifestyle, that they need to not smoke and drink, and they need to lose weight. We're hypocrites. We can't even fix, we haven't even fixed our own home. And yet we're out trying to tell other people how to repair theirs. And that's sort of what's helped birth BRICS, bring BRICS to the forefront. They're sick and tired of the United States trying to tell them how to live their lives. And what you find at BRICS is when you show up, Vladimir Putin doesn't launch into some lecture about, like with Maduro from Venezuela. He didn't say, man, you acted like a real thug in this last election and you're doing this wrong. No, that's not how you get change with people. You start with some acceptance. Doesn't mean you have to agree with them, but at least you have some respect. You respect them in terms of their personhood and their individuality. And that's one of the things I don't think people capture what comes out of these kinds of gatherings. You know, it's like when I went for the first time to Moscow and, met Pepe Escobar in person. You know, we had some exchanges or email, but man, once you meet somebody in person, and then Alistair Crook and his wonderful wife, Aisling, and you form friendships. And so it's now, they're not some abstract. They're real. They're tangible. They're genuine. And you've got a way that you can converse and talk to each other. That's what happened on these 3 days at BRICS. These leaders from these major countries around the world, outside of the control of the United States, were developing relationships. And that's very powerful. And that's something I don't think a lot of people take into account.
Is the reality of BRICS finally hitting the West? Because if you remember when this summit started.
Come on, man. Okay, we're gonna have to have that urine test to see what drugs you've been taking today. Okay. I put an article. I looked yesterday. I pulled up the web pages of the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Politico, the Financial Times. Nothing about BRICS. They're going, BRICS? Are we talking about what's on my walls? They didn't cover it at all. It's like, let's ignore it. Maybe the bad man will go away. It's insane. The West is, we are so vain, so narcissistic, that all we can think about is ourselves and have no regard whatsoever to what's actually taking place in the rest of the world. And or the couple of times that it did get mentioned, maybe the 2 days ago, was that Putin's just holding this summit to try to boost his sagging image. You know, my old boss at State Department, who's a retired Marine colonel, he had a great saying. He just said, "Hey, there's no fixing stupid," and that's right. You know, that's what the West has become: stupid.
We had Lloyd Austin going to Kiev while we had...
Speaking of stupid, Lloyd Austin. Sorry.
What has happened in Kiev, in your opinion? What has he tried to do with the Zelensky administration?
I have no idea. You know, because the situation in Ukraine is... for the Ukrainians, is going from bad to worse. Their defenses along that line of contact that stretches about 900 miles from north to south, they're retreating all across that. In Kursk, the Russians are in no rush to close that off because they're allowing more Ukrainians to come in and they're killing them. They killed... There must have been a unit made up almost entirely of Colombians, and I'm shocked that there are that many Colombians. But man, there were probably like 100, 200 of them. I think they're all dead now; they've been killed. What we're seeing is there's a new an intelligence operation that's been launched. And it started with the news that, North Koreans are on the ground. And even Austin initially said, well, if that's true, you know, because they didn't have any intelligence for that. This was, I now believe this was a device, a plan that was hatched with Western intelligence. Because they're going to put out, the North Koreans... are in Russia fighting. So what's the repost? Well, apparently, South Korea has dispatched a fighter wing, so at least 30 pilots, to Romania to fly F-16s because the Ukrainians don't have trained pilots. South Koreans do. And so they're doing this under the justification that, so North Korea's there, so we got to send South Korea. This was hatched as a pretext. This was their plan all along was, how can we put South Korean pilots who are willing to fly and fight against Russia into theater? Let's say that the North Koreans are there already. Now look, Russia has had strategic relationships with the North Koreans for 75 years at least. You know, it's the North Koreans have always been friends with the Russians, not necessarily the Chinese. And there have been North Koreans over the years that have trained in Russian military bases out in Vladivostok, out there near Korea. So there was absolutely no evidence whatsoever that North Korean troops were on the ground. And let's say there were 10,000. Russia's got 800,000 troops on those front lines right now. 10,000 doesn't make a bit of difference. Not at all. I am now thoroughly convinced, a Western intelligence, psychological, it was an information operation to create a foundation to justify putting South Korean troops in. Now, hoping that the South Korean troops will fly these F-16s, which if they do, and if they launch missiles into Russia, it's likely the Russian response will be to attack those missile bases in Romania. So this is, I think, really a backdoor effort of the West to try to get NATO involved in the war to create a pretext, a justification. But the fact of the matter is, NATO militarily is not capable or competent enough to do anything to help Ukraine. They can't change the outcome of this war. Ukraine is a dead country walking. Can you
hear me?
You're back. Muted yourself.
Yeah. One of the important points, Larry, that she was talking about in this summit was that BRICS should act as defenders of collective security. Mm-hmm. When you look at the way that China, Russia militarily are connected, and North Korea is connected to Russia right now between Iran and Russia, it seems that they're making some sort of BRICS military, but it's not the way that we call NATO. They're having their connections. They're forming their military connections without talking about it.
Well, what you're looking at, BRICS is going to be the alternative to the United Nations. I think there's an increased frustration that the United Nations has become a completely ineffective organization, that because the colonial powers, England, France, and the United States can veto anything in the UN Security Council, that in terms of effective action by the UN, it's just, nothing's happening. And the murder of the Palestinians is a case in point. So what BRICS is looking at is becoming an alternative, developing not just an economic, having economic activity, but also extending into fields of security. But that's still a ways off. But it is right now that you've created the foundation of cooperation between these various countries.
It seems when they're talking about their security is not a offensive manner, it's a defensive manner, as he mentioned. They're not going to attack anybody, but they're totally prepared to defend themselves.
Okay, so let's step back and let's just say, let's list the countries that have carried out military operations where they've dropped bombs on other countries. Okay, that's the United States. You know, you come up with a long list and go back 60 years, Vietnam, Panama, Dominican Republic, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Libya, Serbia,
Laos, Cambodia.
Yeah, so, okay. So let's come up with that list of those countries that Russia's attacked. Okay, well, under the Soviets, they went into Afghanistan. But since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the establishment of Russia, they conducted military operations in Georgia after they were attacked by the Georgians. Other than that, they've not been out conducting attacks and dropping bombs in other countries, except in Syria, where they were invited in by the government of Syria to help them fend off a Western-led insurgency that was trying to overthrow the legitimate government of Syria. How about China? China's not been out conducting military operations, bombing other countries. What about Iran? Oh, Iran's a sponsor of terrorism. Oh, yeah, Iran provides support to Hamas and Hezbollah, who have been victimized repeatedly by the Israelis in their entire existence. We can go through the actual numbers. Yeah, Israel likes to, cry and complain, oh, we've been victimized by these terrorist attacks. And yet when you look at the actual number of the attacks and the actual number of Israeli victims, they've killed 10 times more Palestinians. And they've attacked the Palestinians 10 more times. And now with what's happened since October 7th, it's carnage on an inhuman scale, what Israel's inflicting on civilians. Nobody wants to hear that. We prefer to persist with these myths that, Iran's bad, we're good. Yet we're the ones with 750 military bases around the world. Not Iran, not China, not Russia. And yet they're threatening to take over the world. Oh, please. And on that note, the West can't even, particularly like Lloyd Austin, can't get a story straight. Oh, first of all, they'll say, oh, the Russian army, it's so weak, it's doing so badly. That's why they got to have the North Koreans to come help and the Iranians, because the Russians are really weak. Then in the next breath, oh, we got to stop the Russians, because if we don't, they're taking over Europe. Well, wait. If they're so weak, how in God's name are they going to take over Europe and all the Baltic states? I thought you said they're weak. Now, which is it? They're all powerful or they're weak? Which is it? Come on. Ridiculous.
Larry, before wrapping up, if you were to point out a sane voice in the Biden administration, that would be in the government of the United States right now, would be Pentagon or somewhere else.
There isn't a sane voice.
Because they have tried to avoid the conflict, this escalation between Russia and the United States by just stop sending those long-range missiles to Ukraine. And right now with these leaked documents, I want to know who's concerned about this conflict being escalated.
There may be one or two individuals somewhere in the bowels. Bill Burns, the CIA director, maybe he's finally come to his senses. He used to actually be sane at one point. I mean, the cable he sent out from Moscow in 2008, I believe, was, quite prescient and accurate. Said, hey, the Russians are not going to tolerate any expansion of NATO to the east that involves Ukraine. Niet means niet. No means no. But he went from that to becoming, a full-fledged Kool-Aid drinker and water carrier for the Biden administration. I think, there is a recognition, I think, in part on the behalf of Lloyd Austin that there are limits to what the United States can do, or that we could incite the Russians in a way that it could expand this war, that we're in no condition prepared to fight it, to push back on it. But the Biden administration policy, though, still continues with it. They keep allocating money to Ukraine. We ought to be putting pressure on the other country and say, hey, you got to put an end to this now because you're going to disappear as a country. Russia will dismantle you. They haven't reached that point. And the reason is it's for politics. It's domestic politics which is driving all of this. The Biden administration is not going to do that because they don't want to be seen as having another loss prior to the election on November 6th, November 7th. It's a dangerous time.
But their master, the Biden administration, is master to destroy these people. I think Bill Burns should be the United States Secretary of State. And instead of being in that position, they sent him to CIA. They just ignored him, I think. Well, the way that he could contribute to the administration, they just ignored
him. Look, he could have been an honest broker at CIA, and they really could have been putting out an honest product. I will insist that they've been part of the problem, because instead of producing solid intelligence explaining that, no, Russia hasn't suffered the massive casualties that the Ukrainians have, the CIA has been, enablers of that. Because within CIA, in the military, the Special Operations Division, they are conducting covert actions inside Ukraine that involve training intelligence personnel, training military personnel, training acts of sabotage. And that takes on a life of its own. And so out of that, then, the Ukrainians generate intelligence that is passed to us, that's called liaison intelligence, that then we say, oh, but this is human source. This is the intelligence that we're getting, and it's all based on lies. And so that's why the CIA keeps repeating, instead of coming up with really an independent methodology to assess casualties, as an example. And, the casualties are very simple to count. If using no other metric than how many artillery rounds per day are the Ukrainians firing compared to that of the Russians? It turns out Russia's firing 8 to 10 times more per day. Well, guess what? You're going to have 8 to 10 times more casualties then, which is exactly what has happened. They wouldn't do that. So Burns, instead of making the CIA an honest broker to come out and tell the truth, made it basically a political whore. It was just going to do what the administration wanted it to do, tell it what it wanted to hear.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
All right, my friend. We'll see you on Monday, I guess.
See you, yeah.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.